Welcome to CSF. Most people that listen to CSF probably expect maybe a little bit more of a focus on Kurdistan. So far, it hasn't been really on Kurdistan rather than actors around the Kurds and maybe a tiny effect on what happens with the Kurds themselves. I thought I'd remedy that today by inviting Megan Connolly, a non-resident fellow at IRIS, to explain some of how one part of Kurdistan works, at least. That is the southern part, the Iraqi Kurdistan. And more specifically, how the Iraqi Kurdistan regional government works. Megan, thank you for being on CSR.
Thank you, Aris.
I think I'll start with a softball question and just ask you to define what the KRG is, where does it come from, and who runs it?
Right. Well, the Kurdistan Regional Government is the government of the Kurdistan region of Iraq, which is a federated unit of Iraq. It has an unusual degree of independence in that it constitutionally can have its own military forces. It has its own legislature, its own presidency, and prime minister, of course. And it can establish diplomatic consulates abroad. So it's unlike other federated units in federal states in that it does have these unusually expansive powers, but it is still a federated unit of Iraq. So it, particularly with regards to the budget, about 95% of the Kurdistan region budget came from the federal government, which creates a system of a dynamic of dependency on the federal government. So there are these sort of external influences and these domestic influences that tie the Kurdistan region government to the Iraqi state.
So how did we get here? So how did we get here? How did the Kurdistan regional government come about?
The Kurdistan regional government came about in its first iteration in 1992 after the 1991 rebellion, or the Raparin, as it's called in Kurdistan. And after this rebellion, under a international no-fly zone, the Kurdistan Front, which was comprised of the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, so the KDP and the PUK for brevity, along with some other smaller political parties, they passed a law calling for elections and establishing procedures to hold democratic regional elections in anticipation that this regional government would one day become a part of a liberated federal Iraq. This united government lasted from 1992 after the first elections until 1995. In 1995, there had been an ongoing civil conflict. And the PUK, which had the premiership in Erbil, which was the capital of the Kurdistan Regional Government, was expelled from Erbil and established its own parallel de facto government in Sulaymaniyye. So you had two governments after 1995. You had the Erbil government under the Kurdistan Democratic Party, or the KDP, and the Sulaymaniyye government and that was under the PUK. These two parallel governments, this is an era that people refer to as Dui Dara, or two administrations. They existed from 1995 until 2005. And this was the reconstitution of the Kurdistan region government occurred after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and negotiations for a new Iraqi government. What essentially happened during this period was these two administrations were subordinated to a unified entity, again called the Kurdistan Region Government, but there were different sorts of factors in play. And I don't know if you want me to go further into why this government lasted a bit longer. But for one thing, the source of income was primarily from the federal government. And yes, the parties have their own individual private sources of income, but they're fractionalized and opaque, and sometimes the parties don't even know which sources they're coming from or how much is coming in. So much of the budget coming to pay the civil servants and the government employees was coming from the federal government. So this was something that kind of forced the parties to converge at the center in the Kurdistan region government. The other thing was the vertical division of power between the PUK and the PDK. So you had, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, for people who follow CSED or are listening at the moment, we do have Zoom calls, so she can actually see my face and see how I might want to butt in. I didn't want to butt in, but I've got a question in any case.
So if you need me to back up a little bit, please.
No, not at all. One thing that I wanted to mention a little bit is, I mean, some people might know the Kurdistan regional government a little bit better, and maybe some people aren't as used to how the entity works. But one particular aspect that I think a lot of people might be interested in abroad, because of it's this thing that keeps getting repeated, perhaps sometimes incorrectly, and that is the democratic nature of governance in the KRG. There are elections, and to some degree, you might call them free and fair, even though campaigning in some places might be perhaps less than adequate. But the main actors that used to govern it before democratic kind of institutions took place still govern it today. Why is that, and how does that look? How does the relationship work between the KDP and the PUK?
Well, I think there are two things that you're addressing here. One is the relationship between the PDK and PUK when it comes to administration, and the other thing is how has democracy progressed? And these two things are related. But the KDP and PUK have this relationship of antagonistic cooperation. For almost a decade, they had to cooperate with each other because the dynamics of their power-sharing relationship were such that each party's positions of power, their portfolios in the government, in the federal and regional government, were interdependent. So the PUK had to, example, vote for the prime minister or the president that the PDK nominated in order for the PDK to reciprocate and vote for the Iraqi president that the PUK nominated. I think that the severance of the budget and subsequent instability, economic instability, has really kind of disrupted this power-sharing dynamic because it reduces the incentives to cooperate. This incentive whereby the reason to participate in the Kurdistan region government as this forum for power sharing and decision making, whereby each party acknowledges the other's discretion while maintaining a veto over their decision making. There's not really an incentive to do that if the budget isn't coming in, if the money isn't being shared. So each party kind of falls back on its independent sources of revenue, which don't really benefit most people. They tend to benefit the more powerful clients in both parties, but they don't pay salaries. But when it comes to democracy, this has been, this idea of consensus government and sharing power between political elites has never really been, it doesn't sit comfortably with the idea of consolidating liberal democracy. And I think that we see through 2015, we see a transition where the PDK and PUK had, of course, expected electoral mandates to confirm their hegemony in the region. They had a electoral bloc in parliament. They were going to share posts with one another. It was almost guaranteed. There was nothing to challenge that. But once Goran, the change movement emerged, and the change movement was a splinter party of the PUK. It was founded by Nashirwan Mustafa, who was the deputy secretary general of the PUK in 2006 or 2009. This is when we see this idea of consensus challenged, and the idea that breaking up these large political blocks and devolving powers to local governments, empowering parliament, and giving civil society a voice in politics is really how the Kurdistan region should evolve. And really, it's never been considered legitimate to keep this sort of consensus system operating, but it's just been how it worked. And so Goran and related movements were very invested in changing this. And you did see a little bit of a liberalization of the system in 2011 after the protests, but not much. For example, after the 2011 protests, there was an amendment to Law 4 of 2009, which was the provincial electoral law. It removed the closed list and replaced it with a semi-open list from which voters could choose individual candidates. So instead of a electoral system that incentivizes the election of very disciplined, cohesive parties, you have a system that, you know, encourages more participation, individual participation in the electoral process. But at the same time, you also saw like the establishment of the Kurdistan Regional Security Council, which responded to the unrest in Sulaymaniyah and the need for coordination between the PUK and PDK in this sort of centralized, I guess, council, which it didn't work that way anyway. You have a Sulaymaniyah chief and you have a Erbil chief, which of course used to be Masrur Barzani. So the democratization process has always been between this idea of consociational democracy, or the division of power between groups that represent salient constituencies, and this idea of liberal democracy, whereby individuals participate in the process. And now it seems like consociational democracy, consensus as they call it, has really won the day. And even Goran now participates very actively in this sort of division of posts and privileges amongst the political parties as salient social blocs.
I think the Goran thing is, I mean, it's one of the things that I didn't really record this part, but beforehand I told Megan I was a bit of out of the loop because I'm so depressed by Iraqi Kurdish politics. The Goran thing always, even hearing Goran kind of puts a little bit of a thorn in my side, because there was a lot of promise and very little to show for it. But you mentioned one thing that I was going to ask later on, but might as well do that now. It is because after 2005 and after the kind of de facto regional government became de jure regional government, some things were supposed to happen that didn't. You were supposed to see a unified ministry of security. All the security institutions were supposed to be unified. Peshmerga Institute, Asayish, that's intelligence gathering, etc., was supposed to be unified, as well as a few other ministries. But this hasn't happened nearly at all. I think a few battalions of Peshmerga have been put under the ministry directly. but the rest aren't, and don't seem to be going in that direction either, to be honest. And if you go to any Asayish office in Sulaimani, they'll be a PUK affiliated one, and then you go to the yellow zone, so to speak, the Erbil or Duhok, and you'll go to the KDP affiliated one. What incentives do they have to keep these apart? Why haven't the parties unified these securities establishment? And why is that such a hard thing to do?
Well, I think it was Sardar Khader who described it as civil war government. It's more of a security dilemma than it is an actual government. And essentially, the Degola line is still there. The line that separates the or that used to separate the Erbil-based and Sulaimaniyah-based administrations. They're still heavily fortified. And most of the Peshmerga units that were created were not created to send to the border to defend the region from external threats. They were created to sort of build up this line and protect strategic assets from one another. So there is still this fear that if one party is able to gain too much power in the KRG, that they will overtake the other party's zone of influence. It's like the green zone, which is the PUK's, and the yellow zone, which is the KDP's. So there is this kind of understanding. Both parties denounce it, of course, but there is kind of an understanding that there needs to be some sort of protection from this kind of overreach. And because of a lack of information and a lack of trust, they've just never been able to unify these units. And also their economic incentives as well. For example, when the PUK was dominant in Kirkuk, it had units protecting, of course, these strategic assets. The PDK in 2014 moved forces into Bai Hassan and Havana oil fields. So the PUK built up its forces there. So you've had this kind of back and forth where the parties are protecting their assets. They're protecting this sort of historical administrative area that they consider themselves entitled to as well. But there is also a recognition that they have to cooperate with one another on some level. Hence the creation of these unified units. But again, they're separated into PUK and PDK commands. So it's not really unified in that sense. It's more, I guess, the parties are more accommodated within the unified units. This is the same with the ministries as well. For example, and I think the antagonism has sort of outweighed the cooperation at this point. But for example, in the Ministry of Interior, which also commands troops, Lahore Sheikh Jangi Talabani, who is now the co-president of the PUK, has told PUK people in the Ministry of Interior to only report to the Brigadi Wazir, which I think is like secretary of the Ministry of Interior, which is a PUK official, instead of the Minister of the Interior, who is a PDK official. So you still have this dynamic within the ministries. It used to be a little bit, some time it was a little bit more cooperative, I think, but like you had this relationship between Qubad Talabani and Nechervan Barzani that was quite good, in fact. But now, with the parties, both parties becoming more hardline, I think that's changing. They're putting more pressure on their people in the government.
I think I'd like to ask, this is something I usually don't do, because the format is I ask you a question, I listen to your answer, mm-hmm. and I'm usually astounded, happy, and so on. But I have this thought of how things have changed. A few things have changed. There's a new government in place with both the KDP president as well as a KDP prime minister. So it's the central positions are quite KDP affiliated. But one thing that seems to have changed in my lifetime is the uniformity of both parties seems to have kind of split a little bit, that we can see wings of each party. The PUK is a lot more pronounced. You can definitely tell quite openly, usually because they hurl insults at each other often, which kind of wings exist and how they relate to each other. And even sometimes there are battles, so to speak, where you can tell who's won. But the PUK is, the KDP, pardon, is a little bit different in that they still have the head of the party alive and well and exercising quite a lot of power to keep things or how they should be, so to speak. But regardless, it's impossible not to see the tension there as well, as well as the contrast between how maybe one wing would have governed things had they still been in power, and how another wing governs things today, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. How do you see it? Do you see the same thing I do? I mean, you've been studying it for a while. Have you seen this change, or is it just something that I never noticed until suddenly it popped into existence?
Well, I think particularly with the PDK, there were a lot of rumors about this feud between Nashirvan Barzani and Masrur Barzani. And as a matter of fact, Nashirvan Mustafa had written about during the 2005 government formation negotiations that Masoud Barzani had demanded that Nashirvan be the prime minister because he would not become president over Nashirvan's dead body. So there were already these sorts of feuds within the PDK, but they had never really come to the surface because Masoud Barzani really held down, he really kept them from boiling over. But now that Masrur Barzani is prime minister, it's become quite obvious that he has major differences of opinion and possibly some personal problems that go much further back when it comes to administering the Kurdistan region. One of his first acts as prime minister was to remove Nozad Hadi from the governorship of Erbil and replace him with Firsat Sofi, who was an MP, and he's quite close to Masrur Barzani. He just recently removed Nashirvan Barzani's, I guess you can call him a loyalist from Duhok, Farhad Atroshi, and replaced him with a Peristan man. I'm trying to think of his name now. Oh, Dr. Ali Tatar. So he's been doing quite a bit of that. And the divisions are pretty apparent right now. It's also been apparent in the way that, for example, the KDP, or Masrur Barzani and his affiliated forces, Asayish, have approached journalists that are affiliated with Rudal. And, for example, Rebwar Karim Wali has been the kind of a focus of KDP intelligence recently. So the relationship between the two has markedly deteriorated. Whereas on the PUK side, the PUK has tried to contrast itself with the PDK now, and several officials have issued some kind of snarky statements about, well, we don't know who we talk to in the PDK anymore, which is kind of what the PDK used to say about the PUK. But it's pretty clear that in the PUK, Lahore Sheikh Jangi Talabani has taken the reins in that party, and he is keeping people in line. Although there's still dissatisfaction with him, of course. And there's a difference between the party and government and the Politburo. Qubad Talabani is seen as a very different sort of person than Lahore Sheikh Changi, and he has his own adherence. But I think Lahore Sheikh Changi is very much the man to listen to in the PUK right now.
This is kind of a personal note, but I remember a few years, this was 7 years ago, I think, I spoke to my dad about him. I said, Lahore's an interesting guy. He's on social media, he gets in contact with people, and he speaks his mind, as well as that he's taken a lot more of a nationalist tone in how he describes some things. And I said that he's probably going to be party leader one day, and my dad laughed it off, saying that's never going to happen. I understand it in hindsight that obviously that was a weird thing to say, because he was nowhere near the powerful position he is today. But it's been really interesting to see how the PUK has changed from something that I think a lot of people would describe as maybe a defunct party almost.
Yeah, it was a free-for-all.
Yeah, it was really once. It was a really quite nasty for a while, how the splits had cemented themselves. But now it seems more and more they're coalescing around at least the idea of a central leadership and stopping their infighting in order to benefit somehow. I don't know how much of it's genuine. I can't tell because of how harsh maybe comments have been in the past and how some interests still haven't been kind of fulfilled. There's a few people that would like their kids to be maybe in certain positions of power. That hasn't gone to plan as of yet. So that things might still change, but it's been interesting seeing this shift. How the PUK seems to be kind of stabilizing. But nevertheless, it seems like both parties having these splits, having them so visible, is a threat to the KOG. How do you see it? Do you think internal rivalries might be egged on by maybe individuals in the other party? Or do you think this is kind of a Pyrrhic victory if that happens?
Well, I think that was definitely the PUK's Achilles heel for a long time, because they had these different factions with them. Within the party, you had Khosrat Rasool's faction, which, of course, was the one that Masoud Barzani co-opted to bring the referendum to Sulaymaniyya. And Lahore Sheikh Changi was the holdout there and the Kirkuk branch. So that was always a threat for the PUK. I think some of these factions within the PUK have discredited themselves, like Khosrat Rasool, first with the referendum, but then he became somewhat prominent again in negotiating the government formation deal with the PDK. But this relied in part on installing a governor in Kirkuk, and Khosrat Rasool was seen as compromising on a PDK, veto on that issue. And there's still no governor in Kirkuk with a PUK membership. So I think that was a major issue that discredited Khosrat Rasool, but also the fact that Lahore Sheikh Changi is so... he's so charismatic, and he's very much a Sulaymaniyya-centered person. He sort of evokes these memories of civil war and victimhood in people in Sulaymaniyya, and people respond to that. But I don't know if the PUK can really do the same thing to the PDK. The PDK is more powerful. It has control over the most important offices in the government. I don't think that the PUK is as, I don't want to say cohesive, but I guess as cohesive as it is right now, could do the same thing to the PDK. Although the PDK is certainly dealing with these issues that might cause some major problems for it down the road. But I think as long as Masoud Barzani is alive, it's not going to come to a full open rift.
I think I would use cohesive for you in case you're being too careful to use that.
Yeah, I want to be cautious with the word cohesive when we're talking about the PUK.
I do get that. I will use it for you. I'll take the bullet rather than to say
thanks,
that.
Thanks, Aris.
I think Kurdish people, just like any other people, I guess, we've got cultural differences between regions and states and so on. And the KDP area of influence is, I would say, at least in their heartlands, a lot more culturally conservative, as well as maybe traditional in some aspects, not every aspect, but in some aspects, when it comes to hierarchy, especially, and how things work. I think they, at least it's my perception, that they might take the offices a lot more seriously than people might do in Sulaymaniyah, where there's maybe a culture of demonstrations and resistance to power and so on.
Mm-hmm.
These are all prejudices that I have. I mean, I might state that I'm from Sulaymaniyah originally, so my perception of the place might be heavily biased. But even so, I noticed that you don't have the opposition groups forming in even places like Erbil or Duhok, and you might put it down to the government in power not allowing these kind of seedlings, if you want to call them that, to bloom, and not allowing them to take root. But at the same time, I don't see how the PUK would have been incentivized to do the same while all these other groups popped up. It just kind of seems to be that it was slightly more accepted in Sulaymaniyah. And that also means that there's a slightly higher acceptance of, or tolerance of, dissent in these political organizations in Sulaymaniyah. I think it's just cultural, not even based on retribution or anything like that, just that was just something that happened. Whereas the KDP, I don't see debates to the same extent about how things should be done or who should lead the party or so on. Rather, there's broad acceptance of the status quo and of the ultimate leadership of how the party works. And I will repeat again, I'm from Sulaymaniyah. I'm heavily biased.
Full disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure. Not that I'm a supporter of any party. I think people that might know me would laugh at the idea that I would support any party specifically. But nevertheless, I see it in these terms. And just like you say, though, I think that this is more dangerous in the long term, because in the PUK, at least you have these things being stated openly, and people understand at times that these are the rifts and this is how they exist and this is what happens, and they kind of coalesce towards the leadership that it is today. Whereas in the KDP, as soon as Masoud Barzani passes on, what would happen then? Will they suddenly just accept the status quo, or will something else happen? I'm not sure.
Well, I think that's really hard to say right now. I think it's inevitable that there will be problems between the two branches of the Barzani family. But I think, if we can back up a minute, I'm not sure about cultural predispositions or anything like that, but I think when we're talking about tolerance for dissent within the parties, yes, the KDP has typically been less tolerant of dissenting voices within the party, and it's much more, I guess you could say it's more centralized. But when it comes to the PUK, The PUK has also, yes, it has had, there has been a bit more freedom of press in the PUK zone, I guess you can say. But the way that this was approached through when Jalal Talabani was the general secretary was that the PUK was a chapkagul. It was like a bouquet of flowers, right? And it was, there were different parts of civil society that were sort of annexed to the party. And that's really the way it worked. So yes, you could have a disagreement or you could have a dissenting opinion, but if you rock the status quo boat a little too much, then you might find yourself in a world of trouble. And that was what a lot of activists found out in the early 1990s when there were protests in the cities, there were major problems with urbanization, with particularly with squatting. You had a lot of people coming into the cities from rural areas because of mass displacements and joining some of these leftist movements in the cities. And the crackdown was quite severe. So you could have a dissenting opinion, but it had to be within the context of the PUK narrative. And I think most people after a while sort of accepted this. Whereas the PDK has just never really tolerated it at all. And you know, that's another thing. In the early 90s, there were these sorts of movements that were kind of affiliated with movements in Sleimani and Erbil, and the PDK completely cracked down on them. There was none of that in Duhok, Zaho.
I think that the largest kind of opposition that the KDP has had to deal with has been what they saw as the accepted opposition in the Islamic movements, right. Various ones. That, from my experience anyway, and in Duhok especially, was they wouldn't accept, for example, in campaign trails and so on, they wouldn't accept Goran the campaign or people that maybe were not heavyweights within PUK to campaign and so on. But they did accept Islamic, Kurdistan Islamic Group, and so these guys, but it had a boomerang effect, being that an effect they didn't deal with, which was that if they're the only opposition to the KDP, regardless of whether Islamists are very popular in Duhok or not, they would get all the opposition votes, which made them quite popular for a while.
But at the same time, the Kurdistan Islamic Group was also, we're talking about a party that was kind of the proxy party for the PDK in Sulaymaniyah during the era of two administrations, the Duodara era, and that still has, because it doesn't really have a lot of its own sources of revenue or anything like that. So it does rely on the PDK and, you know, to some extent, the PUK's goodwill to obtain offices in the government and parliament and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're mentioning Goran somehow as well.
Recounting
the story. Yeah, you know, it's just I think it mirrors a lot of these places. You mentioned, God, I always get this word wrong, but consociationalism. I think it's consociation. Yeah, consociationalism. God.
I try not to use that word because I hate it.
It is so difficult. I can't remember who the author
is. I think consensus government is fine.
But what's the name of that academic that...
Aaron Leiphart.
Yeah, Leiphart.
Yeah.
I hated learning about it because it was so idealistic in a way. But anyway, Lebanon works that way. It's the most obvious kind of example, but it's legalized. De jure was the neither Iraq, which also kind of works that way, nor the KRG has any kind of legal requirement for how this works. It's just that you understand this consensus that this is how it has to be. It's consensus for consensus,
right?
I did have a point with this, I thought, but maybe I didn't. But the thing I was going to ask which I think a lot of people might find interesting, because there's varying ways to view this, is how Turkey and Iran relate to the parties in the KRG. And what I mean by that is that within these two different zones, so if you're in KDP affiliated areas, you refer to the PUK as Iranian, or they're backed by Iran, the Iran's men, and so on. Whereas in Soleimani or Halabja, you might refer to the KDP as Turkey's men, or Turkey, you know, the Turkey affiliated, and so on. But how do these relations actually work, and how do these foreign states play into the politics of the KRG?
Well, I think to refer to the PUK as Iran's party and the PDK as Turkey's party is kind of drawing a hard line where it doesn't really exist, because both parties have relationships with both governments. Because the PUK zone, the green zone, borders on Iran, then yes, necessarily it would have perhaps a closer relationship with Iran than, say, the PDK, which borders much of its territory borders on the Turkish border. But yeah, both parties have a history of interactions and diplomatic relationships with both governments. And I think in particular, it was kind of interesting when, after the referendum and October 16th, 2017, when the PUK withdrew, well, both parties withdrew their forces from the disputed territories. One of the insults hurled at the PUK was that they were Iranian Josh, or they were Iranian traitors. Whereas the PDK has a long relationship of a long history of diplomatic relations with the Iranian government, even after the revolution. And so this is not something that, and also with proxies like, I guess you could say the IMK, Islamic Movement of Kurdistan, that Iran had armed and trained in Iran. So you have these different, it's a bit murkier than just the PUK is Iran's party and the PDK is Turkey's party. And also on the other end, the PUK has over the past few years arrested members of a political party, Tevgeri Azadi, which is considered, they consider themselves to be like a branch of the PKK in Soleimania. And the PUK has had sort of an on-again, off-again relationship with the PKK. They used them in the Civil War. They abandoned them again when they tried to establish relations with Turkey. And then when the airport got shut down a couple of years, flights were grounded from Turkey into the Soleimania airport, Gulbad Talabani made an initiative toward banning Tevgeri Azadi in Soleimania. And of course, you have rivalries within members of the party as well. Lahore Shekhchangi has always been considered very close to the YPG, PKK, Tevgeri Azadi. These groups, whereas Gulbad Talabani is kind of considered a consensus guy. He's willing to compromise with his PDK partners on these issues. So, yeah, it's a very blurry line. And I'm not sure we can really draw a hard line there.
No, I mean, I live for these blurry parts. I think that's why we're all employed. Is these blurry points
right.
make sense to us? At least we want to find out what's behind it. Megan, actually, I have a lot more questions, but I think just time wise, I should try to wrap this up, and I'll just end up by saying thank you very much for being on CSSET, for giving your ideas and thoughts and background to how the KRG works, and also congratulate you on the new job at Iris, and hope you do really well there, and I can't wait to read what you write.
Thank you so much, Iris. Thanks for having me on.